OTB's Mount Rushmore. 32 counties. One county representative choosing their sporting Mount Rushmore. Some decisions are easy.
And I was seeing teachers who had never expressed any emotion whatsoever lose their mind when Sonny was running in that home straight, trying to catch that gold spot.
Others are controversial.
Mayo's greatest celebrity fan now helps him earn his place on Mayo's Mount Rushmore is Kevin Kilbane.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
George O'Connor, 17 summers in purple and gold.
And catch the live decision making over the next few months on OTB AM, live every weekday at 7:30 AM on OTB Sports Radio. The OTB Podcast Network.
Monday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
Now, you're very welcome along. So, in lieu of the lack of games at the moment for Monday and Wednesday night rugbies,
now,
quite often we have
ever.
Been interviewing different players about their careers. I'm very happy to say this evening we have a man with three European Cups to his name, four Pro 12s, a Premiership with Leicester in 2007, 13 Irish appearances as well, went to the 2011 World Cup. Shane Jennings, I am talking about you. Hello, you're very welcome.
Joe, how are you doing? You well?
Yeah, great. Can I just kick things off with one of the great stories we ever had on the show? This is you in fine form at the Olympia. And for context here, Michael Cheka was the guest of honour. And you told a story. If you picture Cheka here, he is both horrified that you're telling the story, but he also finds it absolutely hilarious as well. So have a listen.
When you talk about the dressing room, like, there was such genuine characters and great fun. There was one guy, Stephen Keogh from Limerick, who was playing up in Leinster for a fair few years. And he was behind Rocky as every other six, or if Rocky was playing seven, every other seven would have been behind him. And we were training in Donnybrook that day, and we'd go back up to David Lloyd Riverview where our dressing room was, and there was a few that were up there a bit early, and Cheka was back in his office, and word got up that there was a crash in Donnybrook, and it was Rocky. And people were like, really? Jeez, I hope he's okay, blah, blah, blah. And as the word was going around, you see Cheka bolt by the door, out the car park and up the car, and Kel puts his head out the window and he's like, he goes, don't worry about it, it's only Kevin McLaughlin. So then he goes, oh, fair enough, and turns around and goes back into his office.
One of the great stories.
Yeah, sorry, Kev.
So, thanks so much for doing this. I know you're not a man prone to do lots of interviews. You are retired 5 years now at this stage and still clinging onto your 30s. Belated happy birthday.
Thank you, Joe.
So, how's life now? Because you're, what, 5 years out of the game, retirement at 33. You said at the time, you see genetic freaks that are coming out of school into academies beating me up every day. I'm glad to see the back of it.
Yeah. Pretty much. Well, first of all, things are great, thankfully. Yeah, life is good. And I think I was right. At 33, my body was pretty bashed and beaten up. And I was fortunate that I got to that stage in terms of it didn't end before that. And I had a decision if I wanted to continue or leave. And I took it all into consideration, a number of factors. And thankfully, I was happy with the decision. And I just look back and I'm very, very lucky to have enjoyed such a good career with such good fun stories like that and such good characters that we all played with. So, I don't miss playing. And I think that says it all in terms of thankfully it was the right decision. And it was funny, not to kind of harp on about it, but I remember seeing a thing, I've said it before, on an NFL documentary, and there was a guy, I think it was Vince Carter was his name, he was a quarterback for the Vikings, and it was an NFL symposium, they call them, where a lot of rookies come in and they try and give them advice and don't lose your millions in Vegas in a weekend and this kind of idea. But this guy just said, listen, when I finished, I just drew a line under it. And I said, I could never recreate what I did when I was a younger man. I could never recreate that dressing room that we had or the bond that we had. So I was just happy to park it and move on. Whereas I kind of tried to do that. And thankfully, you know, I still got good friends and we keep in touch. But you can never take those days back. So you got to enjoy them.
As I understand it, you would have had an opportunity to go in and get on the Leinster coaching ladder and you decided not to. And I think you were quite sure of your decision not to. Why were you so sure that professional sport and the coaching life wasn't for you?
I don't really know. I remember towards like the middle of my career, I was enjoying rugby, but my body was kind of playing up. My knees were bad and my neck was bad. And this was kind of when I was about 27. So I was kind of going, jeepers, if I get another year or two out of it, I'm doing well. And you're kind of thinking of what's the next step. And at that stage, I really thought I'd enjoy it. But then as I kind of grew up a bit in terms of maturity, in terms of, do you know what? I remember Owen Redden said something really, it was pretty basic, but it was kind of, it was a bit of an epiphany. He goes, you got to enjoy coaching as much as you do playing, because the demand and the toll and the pressure, if you're willing to take that as a coach when you have very little impact, when you can go out on a Friday, Saturday or Sunday and play, you got to really love it. And at that stage I didn't, and the opportunity came up. I remember Leo gave me a call, and I think it was the right decision when we thought about it, and it didn't go any further, but very flattering. But I think desperate times, and when I lived with Leo in Leicester, and he'd watch Pro D2 French rugby games on a Saturday morning, and then Super Rugby, and then play, and he was just like a sponge absorbing it, where I was eating McFitty's Gold Bars and having Cherry Coke and getting ready for a game. So he was made to be a coach. I was probably made to be something else.
Okay. You asked for too much money is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, never even got that far, to be fair.
And how do you find the world of business then? I know initially it was property, and now it's home care for the elderly. These are the kind of spheres that you've been working in. So it's in an office, it's tie on, it's the corporate world. I wonder sometimes how translatable a lot of the skills from rugby are to that world, really. It's not like you have brutally honest video sessions on a Monday with your colleagues.
No, you certainly don't. And I'm very much in my infancy of it as well, and I'm very aware of that. So thankfully, I've got good people around me, and I was given a bit of a break to come in and learn from people. And there's no place like, though, you're thrown in the deep end, and it's difficult. And I've been in my current job for 4 years, and the first year and a half, 2 years, it was tough. And fortunately, I think if you're aware of that and you're aware of your inability, you just keep the head down and you try and learn off good people around you. And that's no different to what it is in rugby. But yeah, and I think when you're older in rugby as well, you probably learn to appreciate that just because you do it one way doesn't necessarily mean it's the best way. You have to take on other people's ways of doing things, opinions and quirks and differences, and they get the job done. So I think that's what I've kind of been aware of in what I would call the real life or the real working world, because when you've got 35 young men with one guy who's telling you what to do, or a group of coaches, you're pretty tunnel visioned, and you're all singing off the same hymn sheet, whereas we all know life's a bit different than that.
Mm. To jump back to the other end of your career then, so you were at St. Mary's. I'm reliably told you were seen as a really big prospect coming out of school. Was it seamless to make your way into Leinster and get a pro contract and make your debut by 21? Did that side of things all come relatively smoothly?
When you look back at it, it probably did. I was very fortunate in terms of, I wasn't far off the same size I am now when I was about 15 or 16, so I had a bit of an advantage. But I remember my year in school, we had a particularly good crop of players. Like, there was guys like Gavin Duffy and Dennis Leamy and these kind of guys, Roger Wilson, where we all played interprovincials against each other, and then we played Ireland schools together. So we had a real strong level of talent in schools, and then under 19s and 21s, the system was a bit different then, and I was very fortunate where I had the opportunity to go into the Leinster Academy when I had just been playing with St. Mary's up in the club with the likes of Trevor Brennan, Victor Costello, Malcolm O'Kelly, and like kind of Peter Smith, Gav Hickey, Peter Coyle, they were in the pack, Emmett Byrne. So, and I was lucky I played with my brother, which I really enjoyed up in St. Mary's as well. So I kind of left school 18, 19, played with a really good club team. And that was kind of the bit of the avenue that Matt Williams gave me an opportunity to come into the squad. And yeah, it was great. It all seemed pretty easy when this is how it goes. And I think I signed a big €3,000 contract at the time to get into the academy.
Wow. This was obviously a very different time for rugby, for Leinster as well. win or lose, we're on the booze. You made your debut in 2002, I think, against Glasgow at 21 years of age, I was reading. So those first 4 or 5 years at Leinster, you make 42 appearances. What's that period like for you? Are you a model professional? Are you driven? Are you just enjoying the whole thing? Are you frustrated you're not getting more opportunities? Give us a sense of those first 4 or 5 years for you.
Yeah, I wasn't a model professional at all. No, I was studying at the same time, and you'd go out with your college mates on a Wednesday night to some college night, and you go on the piss, and then you tell the coaches that you've got lectures on a Thursday morning, and you tell your lecturers that you got training on a Thursday morning. So you end up sleeping in and wearing your hangover off. But I'm kind of glad I did that as well, because I look at the guys now and I just hope they enjoyed as much as, well, I certainly did, and what I feel our generation did, in terms of there was a good balance. We weren't the most professional, but we worked hard. But I was completely immature, and in my infancy as a professional, I was living at home. I was mammied. If I can get my fucking rugby gear washed for me coming home from training, watching TV and get my dinner made for me, like, it was just ridiculous. So, like, it wasn't professional. But I there was a bit of a dawning, even at a young age, where I was like, Jesus, look, we've got so much talent in the room here, and we can't win and we can't perform. And even as a young guy, I knew my place, and that's the way I would be in terms of just in general in life. You kind of keep your head down and you earn your stripes a bit. But I just thought the senior guys were probably in their infancy of professionalism as well. A lot of those guys would have played amateur, played Leinster interprovincial games, but they were learning as they went along, as were the coaches, as was the structure. Mm. But it showed in terms of how they acted. We did go on the lash a bit, and as did every other team, I'd imagine, but we just didn't understand what it took day in, day out to be a professional and to maintain those standards and to look after yourself and to make sure the most important thing when you're a professional is winning. And it's a brutal profession, because that's what you're judged on as an individual and as a team, and you have to learn the hard way, unfortunately. And I think that's what we certainly did as a group.
From the outside, the 2 years at Leicester look like the making of you. 05 to 07, you go at 24 years of age. According to your Wikipedia, I don't know who's written the Wikipedia for you. Maybe you've written it for yourself, who knows. So the word goes is that Leicester were over at Lansdowne for that quarterfinal in 05, where they were dominant. And, you know, Martin Johnson seemed to marshal the whole thing around the pitch. And I don't think you started that game. But Neil Back made an approach to you after the game, is how the story goes. Is that what happened? Is that how Leicester came about?
I don't actually know. I've definitely have heard the story. And I know Backy at the time, when I went over, he was on the coaching staff. He was retiring, and he had said, listen, in the lead up to that game, I had played quite a few games, because Keith Gleeson, who played the game with Kieran Potts in the back row that day, Keith had been injured. So I'd played quite a few games during the season. And they said, well, when we were doing our prep, I liked what I saw from you, and I think you have potential and blah, blah, blah. But I think it was more Paddy Howard that also had kind of saw something that he wanted in his team. And after the game, that kind of came to life. But it was funny, when I was in Leicester, I remember Paddy was showing me a video of the prep that they had done before the signing, and they had a few video clips of me. And they showed a few, like, brooks or tackles or, and then a few tries, and then they showed one try, and I was like, oh, Jesus, this isn't me. And I was kind of going, where's this going? And it was in Lansdowne Road against Newport, and Niall Ronan took this absolutely sweet line off a line out, chipped over a fella, caught it, dotted it under the post. And he goes, see, that, if you can bring some of that kind of flair to the side. And I was just like, yeah, no worries.
This was the moment, Shane, when we said you were for us.
Never told him about it ever. Now, thankfully, there's a few more clips of me after it, but if they'd signed me on that, they got the wrong guy.
Were you looking to get away? I mean, were you sitting there kicking your heels saying, Keith Gleeson's playing, I should be playing? What was your sense of the situation?
No, I wasn't. I was massively impatient and immature, like every professional, I think, probably should be. Mm. And I was no different in terms of I had played that season, and Keith had come back for that game, and I think Declan Kidney was coach at the time, and it was more just a dawning that, listen, Declan doesn't have the faith in me to pick me, right, wrong or indifferent. Every coach has that decision to make, and I never hold that against any coach, but you either shut up or you try and do something about it. And the it was funny, I met my agent for a coffee that I had years ago, who did some of the contracts for a coffee recently there. I hadn't seen each other in years. Yeah. And we were chatting about it. He goes, oh, you had a great career, blah, blah, blah. And he goes, do you remember you went to Leicester? And he goes, I found out recently it was only over about 10 grand. And I was like, geez, that's funny how little it was. But like, I had a value. The point of my story is I had a value from talking to the likes of Victor. And he said, listen, your value is this kind of, this is what ballpark we're getting. This is what young lads get. This is if you've been playing, this is what you should expect. So we went in at that. And let's say if it was 30,000 or 40,000, they came back with 31 or 41,000. I was like, oh shit, this is going to be tricky. So I never wanted to go, never had any desire to leave. And then as it happened, I was in a taxi going over to Leicester from the airport to the club, and the agent rung Mick and he goes, so what do you think? Are you going to budget it? And I think they went up 2 or 3 grand. I was like, God, this is painful. So the decision was made for me. I said, like, listen, and right, wrong, or indifferent, I'm sure Leinster have another story maybe about it, but that's in crux of it what it was. So okay, it was a decision. I remember Paddy Howard threw out the contract and he said, do you want to sign it now? And I was like, oh, no interest in signing. I signed it, and like you said, it was a better decision that I've made, and it was great.
And were you at that stage going over at 24, were you still living at home? Was mum still making your dinner and cleaning your rugby gear for you?
Yeah, it was pathetic. Yeah, completely. Right. Yeah, genuinely. It was embarrassing. So, like, now in fairness, I was 23 going on 24. I'll give myself that bit of credit. Right. But yeah, went over. And like, I remember I was living with jeepers. I remember my first weekend in Leicester, I was living with a guy called Effie Takafo, a Tongan hooker, and Sue Rambini, who's passed away. And we're out in the outskirts of Leicester. And I was just like, this is a million miles from what I'm used to. And it was just brilliant. I had to go off and buy a bed, buy some clothes, buy some food, and just grow up and cop on. And it was brilliant in the club. Like, I remember the first day I arrived in Birmingham or East Mids Airport, Richard Cockwood picked me up. Mm. And he goes, right, sit in the car. I don't know you. I didn't sign you. Paddy did. So you got to kind of prove yourself to me. Right. He was kind of saying, but he had the decency to pick me up, talk to me, get a feel for myself. And thankfully, he was one of many good coaches over there. Like, they had a serious setup, and it was just a good environment for someone who was a bit wet behind the ears. And you kind of grew up and you learn from good players, you learn from a good culture, you learn from what it, looking at guys who were playing for England at the weekend and they were rocking up on a Monday morning putting it in for their club. And if you can't learn in an environment like that, you're doing something wrong.
I think it was grizzled, old school, dust-ups and training most days, maybe a few fights on the bus as well if there's a bad result, drink hard, play hard, if you're injured, strap it up, get on the field. We are never physically dominated. Like, a tough environment as well is predominantly how I see it, or how I think of it.
Yeah, your perception is pretty accurate, Joe, yeah. And Paddy Howard, who had played there, was a young head coach. I think he was about 34 at the time. But he had a real appreciation for the value of the club and the culture. But he tried to add a bit of finesse and a bit of guile and a bit of structure to our play when we were there. And he did that. And he knew how to balance the two. But Jesus, like, some of the players they had, like Julian White was propping with Martin Castro Giovanni, and Marcus Ayurza comes along. Like, they just, I think at one stage, out of a squad of about 40, there was 25, 26 internationals. So like, the second team was, the training was savage, and like, if you were picked you were kind of ducking and diving to make sure you got through to be fit for the weekend at times. So, but that was brilliant. And I remember the first Heineken weekend we had, we played against Claremont in Welford Road, and like, we were going well in the league, and you could notably see the lads flick a switch and say, okay, this is Europe. And at the time, Leicester were the standard bearers. They'd won a couple of Heineken Cups, and you could see what it meant to them. And yeah, like, they were good days. Welford Road was a good club as well, a good stadium as well. The atmosphere was good. And if teams were half beaten sometimes before they got over there because of just that perception, like you kind of articulated, that's what teams had in their head. And if you played well and if you started well, usually some of them would run out the gate.
And did you settle well?
Yeah, I did. And it kind of helped that I went over my own. I went straight in with the lads out in the outskirts of the city. They have a really good system where they buddy you up. I had James Buckland, who was a hooker in the club at the time, and he used to pick me up and bring me into training and make sure I was looked after. And then, like, it was my birthday, I think, within the first week or so that I arrived over there, and we all went out in the piss, and I ended up having to wear all sorts of stupid stuff, and you're kind of one of them immediately kind of thing. And like, you know what I mean? I was on my own, I was young, and I had no responsibility, so I couldn't but just muck in and get on with it. So it was brilliant. And they had a load of young lads as well who were in the same position. And the beauty about Leicester, you had fellas who were from there, granted, but you had a lot of other guys who weren't from there. So the only social connection we had was each other. So we just kind of hung around and looked after each other.
Yes. How does a standard run-of-the-mill Premiership game compare to a standard run-of-the-mill Pro 12 game in terms of standards and demands on you?
I personally felt at the time, when I played in the Premiership, your week in, week out, like, I think I played 60-odd games in the space of two seasons over Leicester, whereas you'd never have that amount of games. And, like, the packs are big in England. It's a bit slower. Yeah. They kick lumps out of you, and they kind of pride themselves on that a bit. And then especially in Leicester as well, they physically wanted to dominate teams. So that was the approach of the game. So I remember I came back in a bit of a body bag after 2 years, whereas you can manage yourself a bit better within the Irish system. And unfortunately, the Magners League or the Celtic League, whatever it was at the time, you had a few dud teams, so you knew you could get by. Whereas yeah, dud team in England was still pretty physical and still pretty physically demanding on your body. So that was the only difference. But generally speaking, the standard was pretty similar. Like, we were just lucky we had a good squad and a good team, and we usually came out on top, so we were pretty successful.
And so it's you and Leo Cullen living together for part of this. Best mates.
Best buds forever, yeah. We lived in an apartment together, and it was, yeah, Leo used to do the cooking and shopping, and I was OCD, I used to clean up, and it was a perfect combination. And we lived with each other for, I'd say, about the first season or so, and then we both got our own places, but they were next door to each other, and it was brilliant, yeah. We became very close, and the likes of Geordie, and we had a load of Irish guys over there as well, and just the club was, honestly, I had such a incorrect perception of English rugby, English people before I moved over there, and they couldn't have been more welcoming, and they look after me. And
sorry,
the locals,
and what was their perception?
Well, the perception was off fucking English and this, that, and the other, and, you know, the old enemy and those so-and-sos, and you just had this false guard against, you know what I mean, like, which is wrong, but again, immature on my behalf. And
yeah,
when I went over, they were the nicest people ever. I remember standing at a bus stop one day about to go back from training into the city, and some fella came up to the bus stop. He goes, "Oh, Shane, welcome to the club." I was like, "In God's name, do you know who I am to be me a lifted?" But they're just fanatical about it, like, small town in the middle of England. So it was a cool place to play, though.
Were you itching to get back to Leinster and get back to Dublin eventually?
Yeah, I was, yeah. Like I said, I didn't have any real interest going over, but when I went over, I wanted to stay for probably 3 or 4 seasons, but a personal situation with my mother, she had fallen ill, and I wanted to get home. And as soon as that happened, I immediately wanted to get home. And I was kind of doing trips back and forth after games at weekends, and the opportunity thankfully came for to come back to Leinster after 2 years, where Cheka offered me a contract. So I was delighted to get the offer, and it was just brilliant to come back and to obviously be with my family and be with Leinster. Leinster is my home team, and it was always the team I wanted to play for, so to get an opportunity to come back was brilliant.
You and Leo Cullen are often talked about as, I don't know, cultural architects or standard setters to some extent or other. Sean O'Brien in 2017, I was talking to him, and he said, "Someone I really admired was Shane Jennings. I probably didn't tell him that often enough. Just his attention to detail, his work rate, all about the bigger picture, a complete squad man." Johnny Sexton, in his book, Becoming a Lion in 2013, said, "If Jeno or Leo said something around here, it was law. This is the way your teammates have talked about you and the way you set a standard." Were you very conscious of doing that? Did you arrive back and say, "Oh, the standard here, in terms of habits, isn't what it needs to be by comparison with Leicester"? I'm sure you're going to tell me your role is overplayed, but so many players have talked about it. Give us the sense of what you were trying to do or trying to impose on the Leinster culture, for want of a better word.
Yeah, and I will start it with, though, Joe, because to be fair, it wasn't just me and Leo. Sure. It is genuinely a massive group effort, and it comes from the top down. And it came from Cheka and his coaching staff and a lot of senior players that had been hurt looking at Munster being successful and a lot of young talent coming through. So there was a very good combination and a very good opportunity to kick on. But I think certainly, I'm not speaking on behalf of Leo, but we did talk about it. But from my point of view, I was like, jeepers, we have all the talent, but I don't think we realise what it takes. And Cheka was a good man for that in terms of making sure in training what you do becomes a bit of a habit. And if you can drive yourself and each other, you know, it's not as hard at the weekends when you do it. But I kind of focused. It's strange. People focus on different aspects. I just focused on being quite fit. And I remember, like, if I was top of the log in training, I knew I could bark orders at people, because if I was in the middle or I was at the bottom of the table, your words don't carry that much merit. Mm. So, and I wasn't always top, but I was always there, thereabouts. And it was something that I really tried to do, whether it was bloody cycling, rowing, swimming, running. I just had to make sure that if I was going to say something, that people saw me trying to do that or to the best of my ability. And yeah, there was a few dings and there was a few punch-ups, but I'm not a hard man, or I don't claim to be a hard man. So if I hit a box, I'd be kind of getting into a ball pretty quickly as well. So, But at times we needed a bit of raw emotion and we needed a cause. And it was just a good combination at the time, where the cause was our driver, and the cause was we were looking at Munster being successful and we didn't like it. Cause isn't sustainable. So we knew that the bigger picture was, you know what, we got to drive people, we got to wash the people out that aren't good enough for here, and that comes from the peer group. And then over time we'll develop our game and we'll kind of put a bit of finesse on it. But it's easy to put finesse on it when you got the likes of Brian O'Driscoll, Gordon Darcy, Johnny Sexton, Felipe, these kind of guys. Just the level of talent that was there. We just needed a bit of dog at times, and I think we tried to do that. But like I said, there was plenty of other guys that were willing to do it as well.
Because I suspect you look at it, and you would have seen the encroachment of social media and all that stuff as just anathema. Just get this away from the dressing room. I don't want this in here. I don't want players doing interviews. I don't want it to be about the individual ever. I suspect you are the guy who is calling someone out if they've done three big interviews and they're tweeting every 5 minutes.
Yeah. I didn't enjoy that part of it, to be perfectly honest. And it wasn't really a big thing, but it became a big thing in Leinster. And as I got older, it became bigger. And that's when I also realised that you're not going to change the world here. You're not going to change the younger generation. So you've got to adapt with it. And that's where I think what I started. You've got to be a bit more open-minded and appreciate if a certain individual does that stuff. You've got to be able to take the good of what he's trying to do. But I just don't think there's any place for self-promotion in a team game, and we didn't have that many self-promoters in our squad. And if anybody did, and it was more tongue-in-cheek, it was more lads taking the piss. But there was a message behind the taking the piss as well, that if you go too far, do you know what, there is an issue, because the most important thing here is the team, and the most important thing here is winning trophies. Anybody can try, I don't know, tweet or be popular on social media, but let's kind of focus on what the important things are. And but then that's small. I'm old and grumpy when it comes to that. I think people can do what they want, can't they?
They can, you know, you're proper grumpy old man territory there. So 200 plus appearances for Leinster and just 13 for Ireland. Was this an ongoing source of deep frustration, or was, I mean, the talent in the Irish back row for a huge proportion of your career was substantial, to say the least. I mean, there were some serious operators there. So what was the Ireland experience then for you in the main?
Yeah, like, genuinely, I look back at my career and I have no gripes, I have no complaints, I've no nothing to be pissed off about. But the competitor in me, the part, like, growing up, I wanted to have 100 caps for Ireland, I wanted to be captain of Ireland. Yeah. And when you get close to that, you get a taste for it. And like, even now I look back and I'm not overly happy with my Irish career. But then at the same time, do you know what, I've got 13 caps. Some guys who may have 10 caps, some guys who have no caps may have been more talented and didn't get the opportunity. So I'm also very realistic in terms of that and the way my body was. I remember, like, going to the World Cup, I got in the back door when David Wallace got tackled by Manu Tuilagi and blew his knee out. And I remember I got a late call up, and like just how that came about. I had broken my arm, I think, the final game of the year before, and I was like, sweet. I remember Andrew Trimble was nicknaming me Sweet Chuck in Irish camp. I was going around with this broken arm that was out like with a big stick. And I was doing fitness, like with it, like proper pre-World Cup fitness. And I was just like, I just have to try and get to this World Cup. And the arm came back, but my knees weren't great. I was getting clear rates on my knees. And I remember we walked in from the pitch and carton house, and I was with a couple of the strength and conditioning coaches. And I felt my knee biting and twinging. I was like, oh shit, I'm not going to be able to walk back with them here. And as I turned the corner, it just completely went and locked. I was like, oh, I forgot my gum shield. I've got to bat you lads, go on.
Yeah.
And as they turned the corner, I just sat in the ground. I couldn't walk. And I was there for about 20, 25 minutes. And I was like, oh, and if someone comes along and sees me here, I don't know what I'm going to say to them.
Yeah.
So when you boil all that up, when you have concerns, you have injuries, and when you get through them and you get selected, you go, I have nothing to be given out about here. And I have nothing to be bitter about. So when I got to the World Cup, everything was a plus, and I took it as that. I was like, I'm in New Zealand with it. And the squad came so together. Like, genuinely, it was so enjoyable how that group came together. And everything was a plus. Like, the games were good. Got to play in one or two games. We did really well. Obviously, the Australia game was brilliant. And it was just a brilliant occasion. And the same for the Six Nations. But, like, my Ireland career was bizarre. Like, I think I went played against New Zealand four or five times, went down to New Zealand a couple of times, played a couple of Six Nations games, got on a sub. But, like, some of the lowest of the low points were in and around Ireland and Ireland camps and getting knocks on your door. If you ever get a knock on your door on a Monday or Tuesday night, it's never good. So you have to look through your keyhole and see who it is. And I remember I thought I was going to get my chance. I think Leams or Fez were injured. I said, okay, I'll get a chance now. And I was told I wasn't. I was just like, I think you could see my heart visibly break. But they're the things that happen. But I remember, like, my last cap for Ireland was bizarre. I didn't get selected, and I was like, fuck this. I went out in the piss on a Wednesday, and I remember I was sitting beside Jack McGrath. We're in town having a few pints, and there was a big group of us because it was a down week for Leinster or whatever it was. I think about 11 o'clock at night, my phone starts going, and it was Mick Kearney. And I was like, what is Mick Kearney ringing for at this time? So then I just turned it around or hung up, and then it went again. And I looked at Jack, and he goes, you better answer that. I'm like, we had a fair few on us at this stage. And I was like, ugh. I then went outside, hi, Mick. Yeah. Oh, sorry, I was asleep. What's up? And then he goes, can you come down tomorrow? And I was like, Mick, you're fucking kidding me. What's going on? And he goes, there's an injury. You need to come in, blah, blah, blah. I end up subbing in a Six Nations game against Scotland and coming on. And I was just like, this is kind of typical. Like, I train my whole life, do everything right, and you don't get that many opportunities. And then the one you do, you're out in the town on a Wednesday night. So that's just the way it is. But those things happen. And
were you kind of regularly, like, I always feel like you were next man in territory a lot, and holding a lot of tackle bags. Like, you were very close probably to, you know, double or triple those number of caps. You were probably match day squad or next man in a lot. Is that right? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, probably, yeah. I did hold a lot of tackle bags in Ireland camp, that's for sure.
Which is fun, but, I'm sure.
Yeah, it is. You know, you can give out about it or you can get on with it. And you're in Ireland camp and you have a chance. So there's not too much to give out about.
And that was that your attitude at the time?
100%. Right. 100%. And I'd bitch and moan to myself, or I'd bitch and moan to my mates or my girlfriend, but I wouldn't say it too publicly. And then you dress yourself down and you get on with it, because someone else will do that. If you give out enough, someone else will take your place. So it's funny. I got plenty of opportunities. Genuinely, I got plenty of opportunities for Ireland. I just didn't take them. Mm. And I remember one particular, probably my lowest point when I was playing, we played against Australia in Melbourne, and I'd started the game and we had a good team out. Because usually we go down to New Zealand and we're all stuck together with sellotape and end of a season and bash. But we're in good enough nick, and I'd started the game and I was playing well and I was happy with my game. And then a winger from Australia absolutely leveled me, and I think he popped a rib cartilage or something. And it was something completely innocuous, but I just couldn't go on. I was just like, oh, you're kidding me. And like, that was an opportunity that I just didn't take. I got picked again for Australia a few years later, played pretty poorly. So I can't give out that I didn't get chances, you know what I mean? So when you're playing for your country, you got to make the most of it. And unfortunately, I didn't do that, but that's okay.
You did have the serious compensation of what was going on at Leinster. And when things started humming there, I mean, they really started humming. That just became, it seemed like a self-policing playing group. Joe Schmidt comes in to add on to the work that Cheka does. You've maybe got the best coach in club rugby and beyond in the world at that stage. Players at the peak of their powers. And boom, 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 three European Cups in no time. That must have been just like everything you were hoping for on return. And then some, I suspect.
Yeah, it was just brilliant to be a part of. And like, I remember the first Heineken Cup we won, like, we were in a tiny little office that Cheka had in the back of David Lloyd gym, and there was 40 lads cramped into this tiny horrible dressing room. But the fun we had and the bond we struck and like the standards we set and how we trained and how we drove each other and how we had fun together, socialise, and we were just very, very, very tight. And when you have a cause, it's you against the world. And like, I felt like that, and everybody felt like that. And you talked about people having interviews. Like, I remember journalists coming in, were like, get them out of here, we hate them. You know what I mean? Like, this kind of attitude. Like, it was just so false, but it galvanised us. And that was the first one, which was, to me, the most enjoyable and the hardest one to win. And then, once you get a taste for success, you just want more and more and more. And like you said there, Czechs brought us to a level, and Joe added to it by adding like a technical superiority and a skill level to our game that we hadn't done. But we wouldn't have been able to do that if Czechs hadn't done what he had done. So it was a good combination. And some of the young lads that were coming into the squad were chomping at the bit, and training was just as competitive during the week as it was what I had experienced in Leicester many years ago with the likes of the names we had said before.
And what was your game, Shane? What did you feel you were good at? What was your job when you were really humming for Leinster?
Probably work rate, in terms of doing, I know it sounds kind of silly, but doing a bit of the donkey stuff in terms of, like, if we have a phase play, I was making sure that the ball was clean for second and third phase, and making sure in defensive, I was trying to be a bit of a defensive leader off that seam at the back of a line, being the communicator in our defensive system. So, and that relies on, like I said, fitness, work rate, attitude. Because I knew I wasn't a carrier like Jamie or Sean O'Brien, or I wasn't a line-out operator, so I had to try and have a point of difference in terms of tackle count, in terms of energy and defence. And if I was making 22, 23, 24 tackles a game, that means the likes of Sean, Jamie, Kev can carry the ball, and you get the balance in the team right. And I enjoyed the defensive side of it. I was very vocal. I used to obviously try and lead defence in terms of the video analysis during the week, along with other guys. But that's what I thought my role in the team was, to try and do that. And then obviously your link play is vitally important, but we had enough of those guys around as well. So if I did that part of my game well, the link play would happen. And some days it does, some days it doesn't. But generally that was the balance that we had.
Did Joe Schmidt and what he can, obviously, or what he certainly did bring to the breakdown, did that have a big effect on your game? Did he teach you things about that whole area that were new to you, or maybe do we overstate that when it comes to Schmidt and the breakdown?
I think it's probably overstated a bit, to be honest. I think what was good with him is that he liked the chop tackle, and in terms of getting someone to the ground and getting into that space very, very quickly. And himself and John O'Gibbs were very good in terms of, John used to say, one man, one bullet. So if you're going into the ruck, you got to make sure you clear out somebody and you do your job. And if the first two guys do it, I think that's where Joe really set a standard for us, in terms of, it wasn't something that was magically scientific or strange or different. It was just very, very effective. He says, if you're the first two guys, that's where the damage is done, and that's where you can get clean ball. So you had a very clear target as a player, that if you were one and two into a ruck, we used to call them barrels, like either side of the tackler, that you do your job. And if you do your job, it's up there for the next phase. So, and he was good at that, in terms of, I don't mean to, what I said at the start, to belittle what he was doing, but he just used to concentrate on that element and that basic skill very, very well. And if you didn't do it, that's where those video sessions would come out, and he'd call you out, and the group would call each other out to say, do you know what? You missed your shoulder, you weren't low enough. It was ineffective, hence why the ball was slow. Therefore, we didn't get the space out wide, blah, 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 whatever it might have been. So you just peel it all back. You get your tackle right. Usually, a lot of the times, I was the chop tackler. You try and get up and you try and barge into the space, and then the other two guys are trying to be effective. So it doesn't sound overly hard, but when you get it right, it's very, very effective.
Yes, I'm sure. Have you? Do you stay in touch with many of that team? Are you friendly with them?
Yeah. We've got a great... The joys of WhatsApp, it's brilliant. There's fellas down in New Zealand, Issa, Stan. I'm always in contact with Chris Whitaker. I meet him on holidays the odd time when he was in France. And that 09 group, we obviously had our reunion, so we WhatsApp group. And obviously people are busy with young children and family and some of the lads still playing. But generally speaking, yeah, we've close mates. And it's funny, I didn't fall out of love of rugby. I just kind of didn't pay much attention to it. And now I'm really enjoying watching it, seeing the likes of Leo involved in coaching. Obviously, Gerv when he was at Leinster, Felipe. But John Fogarty, seeing him doing so well as a good mate and seeing him go on to Ireland now was really exciting. So those kind of situations have brought back a real enjoyment for me watching it.
Mm. And a final one, how is the body? It sounds like you patched yourself up a fair bit through the 13 years or so. Are you hobbling around?
But it was good until I signed up to the Dublin Marathon at the start of the year, and I started running for a while, and now my knees are gone again. So the body's fine once you don't go running too much, but generally speaking it's fine. And I go out and play a bit of tennis, play a bit of golf, go out for running, but social more than anything, but nothing too bad.
Okay, good. Listen, thanks very much for giving us your time this evening and chatting about your career, Shane Jennings. I'm sure we'll see each other again soon, one way or another, down the line with some rugby, hopefully later in the year. Thanks, Emil. Much appreciated.
Cheers, Joe. Good talking to you.
Cheers.
Monday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.